Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest.
Welcome to this latest edition of Network Europe. I'm Barbara Gruber. Coming up on the program this week, EU leaders are split over the freeze of Turkey's EU accession talks.
The attitude of Turkey in this Anatolian bazaar that is trying to implement and to establish in its relations with the European Union, in a way, is like asking to European Union to be harmonized with Turkish rules. So I think from the European point of view, it's unacceptable.
Also on the program are Poles, the biggest Europhiles on the continent. Slovenia's erased people are touring Europe, drawing attention to their tragic fate, and why SMS loans could be ruining your Christmas season. Those stories and more, plus our latest December quiz coming up, so stay tuned. But first we head to Riga, where NATO held its first meeting in an ex-Soviet state this week. The leaders of the alliance's 26 member states gathered in the Latvian capital for their annual summit. Afghanistan was at the top of the agenda, as NATO-led forces there have faced fierce resistance from Taliban fighters in the south of the country in recent months. NATO commanders were now calling for more troops and more flexibility in the deployment of their forces in Afghanistan. I spoke with our correspondent Stephen Castle about the outcome of this summit.
I think it's been clear for some weeks that they weren't going to get many more troop pledges. A few have been made here at this summit. But the main area in which the NATO Secretary General Jaap Schäfer has concentrated has been to get rid of some of these restrictions, the so-called caveats, which prevent troops being moved around Afghanistan and moved to the areas where they're needed most. And there was some progress on that here today.
The caveats or limits some countries like Germany, Italy, Spain and France have placed on their troops have been one of the most controversial issues at the summit. Can you elaborate on the progress made here?
Well, there was quite a lot of progress. NATO now says that 26,000 of the 32,000 troops now operating in Afghanistan are operating under reduced caveats. It's not saying they can be used absolutely anywhere, but it's clearly pleased that there's a much more flexibility. France has made it clear that it is willing to have its troops used outside Kabul, the capital, the area to which they were restricted. More trouble from the perspective of the German troops. One of the big issues has been whether or not they should be available to be deployed to the south, to the Helmand province, which is much more difficult and much more dangerous. Chancellor Merkel has got a problem there because she has parliamentary restrictions. So what was agreed was that she, along with the other heads of government, have finally said that in an emergency, they will allow those soldiers to be moved to areas where they're needed if, for example, other NATO forces find themselves under attack.
So we could see German soldiers, for example, in the south of the country?
Technically, we could see German soldiers in the south of the country. I don't think they're likely to go there in any large numbers. And one of the problems, of course, here is that the devil is in the detail, as we say. Who defines what an emergency is? There's even some doubt about whether that will be the exclusive right of the commander or not. And one NATO official said to me, well, you know, this sounds pretty good on paper, but the reality is that it will be tested on the ground by events.
Of course, the focus of this week was really Afghanistan, but enlargement and the future role of NATO in the 21st century were also on the agenda. Were there any serious talks about new members like Georgia and Ukraine, for example?
Well, Georgia and Ukraine were mentioned, particularly by George Bush. I think the most interesting development was the invitation to Serbia to join the Partnership for Peace, which is a sort of waiting chamber, if you like, for NATO membership. And let's not forget that Serbia only a few years ago was being bombed by NATO forces in 1999 during the Kosovo conflict. So this is a pretty dramatic transformation within a few years. Serbia also hasn't got the world's best record in terms of cooperating on war criminals. There are a couple of high-profile people who are wanted by the ICTY in The Hague, and Serbia isn't deemed really to have cooperated fully. Nevertheless, I think they have been offered some sort of consolation prize because of the ongoing discussions about the final status of Kosovo. What it does do is it sends a political signal to the Serbs that if they keep on the right road, if they do cooperate with the West, if they ultimately cooperate with the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, then there is a potential place for them, possibly in NATO and who knows in the EU during in time.
Stephen Castle there on the outcome of the NATO summit in Riga. And from NATO enlargement to EU enlargement, for weeks now, the European Union has debated about what should be done with EU candidate Turkey, which is refusing to open its ports to Cypriot ships. Should the EU partially suspend accession talks or totally freeze negotiations? The European Commission recommended this week a suspension of talks on 8 of the 35 chapters, or policy areas, into which the accession talks are divided. The final decision, though, will be taken by EU heads of states later this month. And it will be a difficult one, as member countries are divided over Turkey. Sweden, for instance, warned that sending negative signals to Ankara could be a strategic calamity, while Finland, the current president of the EU, welcomed the partial freeze. And so does Cyprus, as the Cypriot foreign minister George Lilikas told me.
I believe that the European Union had already decided last year that if Turkey failure to fulfill its obligations, then the whole process of accession process of Turkey will be affected. So I'm expecting from European Union to take a step forward and implement its decision of last year, sending a clear message to Turkey that there is no shortcuts today. If really Turkey wants to accede in European Union. The only way to move forward is to be harmonized with the European acquis, with the European law, and implementing its obligations. So this is what I'm expecting from European Union. But the only one who can help today Turkey is the Turkish government.
But do you think that suspending the talks with Ankara would change the attitudes of Turkey towards Cyprus?
Certainly not, but we twice supported the accession of Turkey. In December 2004 and October 2005, we gave a positive vote to start the negotiation with Turkey. So, and we saw that the attitude of Turkey didn't change. It became more arrogant and more aggressive. So if we have to choose between two evil, we'll choose the less evil.
But total suspension of talks, don't you see a risk there of the attitudes even hardening towards Cyprus?
Yes, there is this possibility. But on the other hand, to let Turkey continue its accession process and to become a member of the European Union as it is today, without being reformed, without being democratized, without changing its own system and attitude, it will be worse for Cyprus. So Turkey cannot become full member of the European Union and at the same time continue occupying the north of Cyprus, to occupying the only territory of European Union, European territory, which is under occupation. So Turkey must decide what is the most important for the future of Turkey, for the progress and social and economic progress of the Turkish people and the Turkish citizens. Is it to become a member of the European Union or is it to continue to occupy the north of Cyprus? They cannot have both. And on the other hand, it's Turkey who asked to become a member of the European Union. It's not the European Union who asked to become a member of Turkey. So if there is one who must be harmonized, it's Turkey who should be harmonized with the European Union. The attitude of Turkey in this Anatolian bazaar that is trying to implement and to establish in its relations with the European Union, in a way is like asking the European Union to be harmonized with Turkish rules and to impose to European Union Turkish terms. So I think from the European point of view, it's unacceptable.
Cypriot Foreign Minister George Lilikas on the current stalemate between EU and Turkey. And while the number of Turks supporting EU membership has been steadily falling over the past year, hitting an all-time low of about 30%, a public opinion survey just released in Poland this week suggests that people there are head and heels in love with the European Union. Even former Eurosceptics seem to have been reconciled with the European Union. Bogdan Zarin of Radio Polonia looks at some of the reasons behind this positive trend.
The latest survey on Polish opinion about its EU membership suggests that 88% or 9 out of 10 Poles are in favor of the European Union. Poland joined the bloc in 2004. Since then, 2 million Poles have migrated to established EU member states, the UK, Ireland and Sweden, in search of employment. Rafał Dymek from the Polish chapter of the Robert Schuman Foundation says that Poles have so far benefited greatly from membership in several ways.
Economic growth, firstly, Poland last year had about 5-6% economic growth, and membership in European Union is one of the reasons of that. The second, free market, and if we can travel abroad all over Europe without any formal complication. And of course, European funds, which help Polish communes to build new roads, new industries, etc.
But what about Poland's Eurosceptics? Far right-wing nationalists and populist parties were trying to convince Poles that joining the EU would be detrimental to their country's national interests. Their negative EU party line fell on deaf ears. In the EU accession referendum 3 years ago, 78% of Poles said yes to membership. Today, 65% of voters belonging to the rightist League of Polish Families, which was against EU membership from the very start, have given a thumbs up to membership. Maciej Gerdych, who represents the League in the European Parliament, says that the recent row over the meat export ban to Russia has prompted League supporters to side with the EU.
I don't think people would want to see Poland standing alone right now. So I think that is the main reason.
Though France and Lithuania have sided with Poland so far, engaging Russia to work alongside the EU still remains problematic. Public opinion, however, seems confident that Poland has a better chance of winning battles as a member of the Club of 25 than if Warsaw would go at it alone. Bogdan Żaren for Network Europe.
Now imagine showing up at a government office to apply for unemployment or to register the birth of a child. You ask for your paper and the clerk destroys them in front of you because you're not a citizen, something you didn't realize until that very moment. That's what happened to thousands of Slovenian residents after Slovenia gained independence in 1991. 18,000 people, or roughly 1% of the population, were purged from the official residence records, thus the name they call themselves, the Erased. This week, a group of the Erased traveled from Slovenia to Italy, France and Belgium to draw attention to their tragic fate. Sarah Elzers from Radio France International met up with them in Paris.
Vit Varga was born in Croatia and has lived in Slovenia most of his life. He moved to Austria in 1989. He explains through an interpreter that when he went to renew his documents in 1992 in Slovenia, he was told that he couldn't do so because he wasn't a citizen.
Then I came to exchange these documents for new. And there my colleague worked, who I knew from the workplace, and I said to her,
Diana,
what's going on? Why can't you issue me a new document? And she said, no, Vit, I cannot do that.
When Slovenia became a country, it offered automatic citizenship to ethnic Slovenians and gave other residents 6 months to apply. 171,000 people born in other ex-Yugoslavian republics, Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia, Montenegro, became Slovenian citizens. 18,000 did not and were barred from social services, jobs, and housing. The Slovenian government purged these people from the national registry without much fanfare, so each person found out individually when renewing documents or registering for unemployment. It took 10 years for these Erased to realize that they weren't alone, and they became organized. In 1999 and 2003, the Slovenian courts ruled that the erasure was unconstitutional, but many are still without rights, or they spent years in limbo waiting for them. So this caravan is an effort to engage the rest of the world, to make this a European issue. Several erased people were in the audience at a panel discussion on Tuesday in Paris. The whole discussion was translated between French and Slovenian. The Slovenian ambassador to France, Janez Šumarada, was also in the audience, and he stood up to correct what he called inaccuracies presented by members of the panel.
I think it's important to clarify some points that were either deliberately hidden or not explained with enough detail. The fact that 171,000 residents opted for citizenship and got it without any problems, ladies and gentlemen. Those who were left were the 18,305, but what was not said was that after 1992, that total number was going down. Already in September 1992, 4,893 people obtained permanent residency permits in Slovenia.
As the ambassador started to translate himself into Slovenian, panelist Jelka Zorn, who's on the Faculty of Social Work at the University of Ljubljana, started to argue with him. Many in the audience cheered. And then several people rushed up to the ambassador, speaking angrily, holding up their ID cards. The ambassador excused himself and quickly left the building.
We understood that it's impossible to solve this problem in our nation state.
Andrzej Kornik is one of the caravan's organizers.
That's why, of course, we have to find another political democratic space in which we can solve such problems. And we think it is Europe.
11 erased have sued the Slovenian state in the European Court for Human Rights. In Paris on Tuesday, French deputies vowed to write a letter to French President Jacques Chirac about the situation.
And also to mention that it's inconvenient that the country that does not solve such problems, which basic rights are denied, maybe it's not suitable to held the presidency of the European Union in 2008.
Ambassador Šumarada says that Slovenia is preparing a law to regularize those who are left. The law will be presented to Parliament. He says that it wasn't done before because previous governments lacked the political will.
Until now, there was never a clear majority in the Parliament to pass a law like this.
Regardless of the numbers of who is in or out of status today, there are many like Asim Skopić who want some kind of recognition. He finally got citizenship in 2003, but it didn't change much for him, he says, because by that time, he was too old to find a job.
I didn't feel any different because many years of my life had been totally destroyed. My life had been ruined.
Radio France International, Sarah Elzis, reporting about Slovenia's erased people. In less than 1 month, Bucharest will be the easternmost capital of the European Union. In the 17 years since the fall of communism, the city has gotten a facelift, but the traces of the past are still visible everywhere. Julian Morrison from Radio Romania International caught up with a team of Romanian and British architects, sociologists and artists and reports on their efforts to give Bucharest a new identity.
Anyone strolling through the streets of Bucharest and admiring its buildings can detect the three major historical periods the city has lived through. There's the golden age of interwar Bucharest, with its gorgeous houses and small palaces built in French neoclassical style. Back then, the city was also known as the Little Paris. All that was abruptly ended by communism, which left behind the Soviet-inspired blocks of flats and mammoth buildings, such as the House of the People, the architectural monster built by dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. Finally, there's also the post-1989 period, which actually equals 15 years of neglect, followed by the present-day chaos of a booming real estate market. Claire Cumberledge is the director of the General Public Agency, a London-based organisation which has completed urban regeneration and redevelopment projects in cities across Europe. She is a bit perplexed by what she sees, especially in the neighbourhood of Rahova, which is behind the House of the People.
I see many different periods of architecture existing all at one time, and it's like a lot of different historical periods have been crushed into one space. The culture to me seems quite private. I think it's hard to understand as an outsider who lives in those buildings and how they live.
The Rahova neighborhood was destroyed by the communists in the early 1980s when they started work on the House of the People, the world's second biggest administrative building after the Pentagon. Most houses were torn down while owners from the remaining ones were evicted to make room for families of ethnic Roma. Now it's a derelict area with wastelands claimed only by stray dogs. Claire Cumberledge is leading a team of British and Romanian architects, sociologists and artists who are trying to establish the specificity of the Rahova district to capture its identity and propose projects to the local authorities in charge with the development of this area that should preserve the identity of the place. They call this procedure mapping. Claire Cumberledge explains.
The groups are looking at particular aspects of the area. So one is looking at the flower trade, one is looking at the social networks, one is looking at the public spaces, and one is looking at the history. And they're looking at those themes and thinking how they might create a map that can guide you through that aspect of the area.
This year, Bucharest has seen an unprecedented real estate boom. Over 50% of all direct foreign investment coming to Romania goes into real estate, and in the last 6 months, land prices have gone up by an average 30%. However, most constructions are done in a rush, without any architectural concept or consideration of public needs. Nathan Colley is a Scottish artist focusing on architecture and public spaces.
When European money floods into Romania, which will happen, land value will go up and control of land will change. There's a real sense that everything that's here will change. So this is a key time to see and to pause and to take stock of what is here, because the speed of the world and already there's outward investment happening in Romania, and the people of this community have to have a say.
Having their say sounds nice in theory, but it's difficult when most of the persons living here are doing so illegally or are simply not interested. Gabi Albu is a young architect from Bucharest who's also on the British-Romanian team working on the mapping of the Rahova neighbourhood for 2 months.
I worked here with the community, with the people. I didn't manage to do anything architectural here. I don't know if a new market or some new houses will solve everything here, because the problem here regards the people.
I asked Gabi if she works with the city council and the mayor of this neighbourhood. Her answer was blunt.
No, this mayor wouldn't care about it. We just tried to go to the city hall and talk to everybody. As long as we made some events, it was okay. But when we tried to involve in decisions and stuff, and we tried to find out what's going on in the area, what are the projects, what are the intentions, and if we can change anything, they just wouldn't answer and they wouldn't come and talk to the people just to clarify everything that needs to be done here.
So it's not just the buildings that have had to suffer from 50 years of communism, mentalities too. And unlike the derelict buildings in the Rahova neighbourhood, mentalities cannot be bulldozed overnight.
Radio Romania International's Julian Morrison reporting from Bucharest. It's all done at a touch of a button. Instant loans via the internet or text message on your mobile phone. The business idea has been in Finland and North America for quite some time, but SMS instant loans were only launched in Sweden in spring this year. Clever and aggressive TV and radio marketing by the private companies involved has made it a smash hit among Sweden's tech-savvy youngsters, eager to snap up loans with low credit checks. Radio Sweden's Dave Russells reports.
This Sweden, the street was asked about what she thought about SMS loans.
There are lots of people who are borrowing quick and easy money on the spur of the moment simply by sending an SMS. And it doesn't always turn out very well for them in the end. You don't have to think through the consequences like you do when you go to the bank and ask for a loan.
Swedes can borrow a maximum of 3,000 crowns. That's around $435. It's also quick and seemingly simple. All the customer must do is send an SMS with his or her personal identification code and bank account number. If the applicant has a clean credit record, the money's placed directly in his or her bank account inside 15 minutes. From the adverts, customers have to pay 600 kroner extra as the cost for the loan, which must be paid back within 4 weeks. However, if the money's not paid back in time, that's where it gets interesting. Kjeld Lindholz works for Kronofogden, the only authority in Sweden allowed to collect debts.
Each individual amount that you're allowed to borrow is not that high. It's at most 3,000 Swedish kronor. But the problem is people who are living under financial stress tend to use this as a lifesaver, short time. They think, okay, I can borrow this money now and I can pay off some other debts. And then they don't quite realize that within 4 weeks I have to pay this back plus the fee of 600 kroner and I still have my normal amount of bills. To transfer that to a yearly interest, it would amount up to 100 to 1,000% yearly interest, which of course is very, very high. So what we heard from our employees is that many people tend to push other bills aside and pay this one and take a new one and take a new one. And in the end, they'll sometimes let the rent, they don't pay the rent. And of course, the ultimate consequence is if you don't pay your rent, you can get evicted. You don't really get the time to think things through. These 15 minutes makes it very tempting for many people to just press the button.
The small but growing number of companies or entrepreneurs offering instant SMS loans operate within the credit laws. That's because there's no requirement to indicate the annual percentage rate of charge if a loan is for less than 3 months or under 200 euros, or to sign a written contract. Kronofogden has 35,000 18 to 25-year-olds on its books with some kind of debt. Kian Lindholz with Sweden's Debt Collecting Authority says instant access to small loans can be a real problem when allied to another latest craze.
The internet poker boom has reached Sweden as well, and there's been a suspicion that it's very tempting when you sit there and the money on your account is low, and you can easily fill up your account with 3,000 and you can spend those on poker. That, of course, is a hypothetical scenario, but we heard people testify about it, that that's what they do, because when they are playing, so easy to think, oh, if I only had 2,000 kronor, I could win this money and pay back everything. But unfortunately, that's not... most of them end up losing those 2,000 too.
So far, officially, since the spring, Kronofogden have chased up 400 people in debt to SMS loan companies. Over half of these are to young people. Not a great number overall, but Kent Lindholt says it's only the tip of the iceberg.
We are concerned not only the number right now, but our biggest concern is that, one, it's probably going to increase, because it's a booming market, and the speed and the easiness which you can take these loans are probably very tempting to young people. They don't quite get the complications if you can't pay this money. Since it's such a new market, we can't really compare it to the traditional loan market that's been around for 100, 200 years. So sometimes when we get the question, but is this really a big problem, the total number isn't that high. And we can only say that, no, it's not that high right now, but our concern is for the future. And the sooner you can start having a discussion around this phenomenon, the sooner we can see that the consumers can make a wise decision regarding it.
Radio Sweden's Dave Russell there reporting on the dangers of SMS loans. And instead of taking loans for your Christmas presents this year, here's your chance to get them for free. Coming up is our December quiz. There is a wealth of Christmas customs around Europe, some dating back hundreds of years. In a particular Nordic country, so-called Yule Brothers, visit farms and towns during the 13 days leading up to Christmas. They're strange creatures, part troll, part prankster in human form.
They come to town one by one 13 nights before Christmas. And if the children are well behaved and go early to bed, they receive a gift in their shoe. If they're not well behaved, they receive a rotten potato.
We want you to tell us in which European country naughty children get rotten potatoes in the run-up to Christmas. Email your answers to contact@networkeurope.org. We have 5 Christmas presents to give away and we'll announce the winners at the end of the month. The email address again, that's contact@networkeurope.org. Or visit our website at networkeurope.org. We always like to hear from you. Network Europe receives funding from the European Union and is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Prague, Radio Slovenia International and Deutsche Welle. On behalf of our pan-European team, I'm Barbara Gruber, saying thanks for tuning in.
I pulled into Nazareth, I was feeling about a 10:30. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where I got my find a bed? Preacher just grinned and shook my hand, and it was all he said. Take your load off, Annie. Take your load off for free. Take your load off, Annie. And Annie, hey, put your weight on me. I picked up my bag, I went looking for a place to hide. When I saw coming in the devil walking side by side, I said, come on in, come on, let's go downtown. She said, I gotta go, but my friend can stick around. Take a load off, Annie. Take a load off for free. Take a load off, Annie. And Annie, hey, put your weight on me. Go down, Moses, there's nothing that you can say. She's like all those waiting, waiting up judgment day. Oh well, look my friend, what about Annalie? He said, do me a favor, stay, keep Annalie some company. Take your load off, Annie. Take your load off for free. Take your load off, Annie. And Annie, hey, put your weight on me.